This is Audible.
All right, try this. Macmillan Audio presents More Myself, written and narrated for you by me, Alicia Keys. Yeah. First word. The moment in between what you once were and who you are now becoming is where the dance of life really takes place. Barbara DeAngelis, spiritual teacher. I am 7. My mom and I are side by side in the back seat of a yellow taxi, making our way up 11th Avenue in Manhattan on a dead cold day in December. We hardly ever take cabs. They're a luxury for a single parent and a part-time actress. But on this afternoon, maybe because mom has just finished an audition near my school, PS 116 on East 33rd Street, or maybe because it's so freezing we could see our breath, she picks me up. The cab inches cross town before finally turning north onto a stretch of 11th Avenue, dotted with peep shows, massage parlors, and crumbling tenements. We pull up to 42nd Street, around the corner from our building. Something catches my eye. "Mommy?" I ask, pointing. I've climbed onto my knees on the seat and pressed my face, crowned with its usual frizz and my hair swept in the box braids, right against the glass. "Why are they dressed like that when it's so cold?" Mom clasps my hand and pulls me back toward her while glancing out the window. There, on the corner, stand 3 women, each rubbing their hands together to stay warm. All are in brightly colored knit dresses with hemlines that end miles above their knees. One is wearing fishnet stockings that reveal flashes of her bare skin. Another has on black boots that extend up the full length of her thighs. None are wearing coats. As locals bundled up in puffy jackets scurry around them on the sidewalk, seeming oblivious to their presence, but probably not, the women's eyes dart back and forth to the other side of the wide boulevard. They look like they're waiting for someone. "Mommy," I ask again, "how come they're out there?" My mother sweeps her long auburn hair to one side, draws in a breath, and looks over at me. "When people go through hard times, Allie," she says slowly, "they often have to do things they don't want to do. These women are just trying to survive." I stare at my mother for a long moment, attempting to wrap my little girl brain around what she just told me. She doesn't explain what a sex worker is or exactly how one earns money. I'm too young for that. She doesn't tell me that the women are controlled by pimps, street hustlers who force them to turn tricks in exchange for drugs or cash. I wouldn't have understood. What she does somehow convey is a truth I still carry with me. The women I've spotted aren't on that corner by choice, but by circumstance. Without another word, I slide down into the cracked leather seat and make a silent agreement with myself. I will never be in a situation like that. Half-clothed, vulnerable, powerless, exposed. I am 11. I already know one day I'll be a singer. I've known that in my gut since I was 4. Even still, my agent has been rounding up all kinds of little jobs for me. One is to model bras and underwear for a department store catalog. I show up at the shoot, flat-chested and a little anxious, even with my mom at my side. Behind a dressing room curtain, I pull on the white padded bra and cotton panties. I then peer at myself, head to toe, in the full-length mirror, not sure how I feel about what I've just signed up for. Moments later, I smile awkwardly into the camera, glancing over at my mom on the side. I don't know why I was nervous, I think, in an attempt to calm myself. This isn't that bad. And then, a few weeks later, the catalog arrives. Here it is, Mom calls out, holding it open to the page I'm on. I reach for the magazine and flop down with it on our couch. My heartbeat quickens as I study the photo. Until that moment, I haven't quite realized that what happened in the privacy of a studio is now on full display for the whole world. My world. "So you mean my friends are gonna see me like this?" I say. Mom, probably surprised at my reaction, doesn't respond. The picture is not at all racy, especially since my boobs are more like tangerines than grapefruits. Yet, I still feel judged, naked, embarrassed, exposed. I am 19. In a few months, my first album will drop and my life will suddenly be divided into two distinct halves. All that came before Songs in A Minor and all the miracles and challenges that followed. But I don't know that yet. As 2000 draws to a close, all I know is that I've been booked to appear on a magazine cover, one of my first. In my business, publicity just comes with a job, particularly for a new artist who's excited to break in. This is my shot, I tell myself, a chance for my music to get noticed. The stylist, my manager, the team at the record label, everyone is eager for this opportunity. The photographer greets me with a firm handshake, and I immediately feel his vibe. Strong and a little bit pushy. A stylist has chosen my outfits, among them a pair of jeans, a jacket, and a white button-up shirt. As I dress, the photographer somehow convinces my team that he'll need to shoot me alone. When I emerge from the dressing room, there's just the two of us on set. "Open up your shirt a little," he directs while firing off a flurry of camera snaps. My spirit is screaming that something is wrong, that this feels sleazy, but my protests, lodged in the back of my throat, can't make their way out. "Pull the top of your jeans down a bit in the front," he urges. If I say no, what doors will be closed to me? I swallow my misgivings, tuck my thumb between the denim and my skin, and obey. That night at home, I cry harder than I ever have. This isn't about me showing some skin, which I'll do on my own terms, for my own purposes in the coming years. It's about feeling manipulated. It's about feeling objectified. It's about a crop of streetwalkers on a corner in Hell's Kitchen and a girl who once made a pact with herself. "What the hell is this?" my manager, Jeff, asked me one afternoon a few months later. He's holding up the magazine cover. I stare at the image and do not recognize the woman staring back at me. Midriff bare, nipples covered by her arm extended across her chest, the slightest hint of pubic hair spilling over the top of her jeans. Everything about the photo is wrong. From the pose itself to the lighting that makes me look washed out, I am beyond embarrassed, ashamed that I've sold part of myself. I now understand why the photographer wanted my team out of that room. A 19-year-old girl is more pliable than a set of her grown-ass managers. Had Jeff been in there, he would have voiced what I couldn't at the time. "Hell no. Close that shirt, take your hand off your tit, and you're not gonna yank down your jeans." In fact, Jeff would have been out there pulling my shirt closed. The photographer clearly wanted a provocative image, but rather than disclosing that vision from the start, he led me into it. On the day of the cover's debut, I pass a newsstand where the magazine is on display. I almost throw up. I want to buy every copy on every stand around the world just so no one will see me in a photo that does not represent who I am. I swear that I'll never again let someone rob me of my power. It's a promise I still work to keep. I am here, in the present, standing on the shoulders of all who've paved my way, in awe of where life has led me. My path to this place began in a city jungle, wove its way through the peaks and canyons of the music business, surpassed all of my wildest dreams, and carried me back, time and again, to a pair of questions. Who am I really? And as I discover my true essence, am I brave enough to live in that truth? Those questions live at the heart of my story. Gathering the raw pieces of my experience and holding them up to the light has, for me, been a transformational exercise in truth-telling. I've spent so many years withholding parts of myself, sacrificing my spirit to make others feel comfortable. But now, I'm done with pretending, with living in a prison of my own creation. I'm done with dimming my light. Writing this book has been about meeting myself with all my wounds and vulnerabilities exactly as I am, and then at last having the courage to reveal my full face. It has been about realizing that in order for the truth to set me free, I must first be brave enough to birth it. I'm a person in process. From the me I once was to the me I am now, I'm also a breathing set of contradictions, a child who has known the greatest love there is, and one who longed for affirmation that eluded me. I've been a builder of inner walls and a barrier of feelings. I've been both someone in denial and a free spirit, an artist in hiding and a hood hippie. And all those spaces and faces have led me to who I am now. Uncensored, fearless, awake. On this part of my journey, I'm at last quieting the noise of our world, removing all the external distractions and opinions and judgments, and tuning into my own voice. I'm recognizing my own power and owning it. I'm finally trusting myself, believing I already have inside me the answers I most crave. And above all, I'm discovering who I am at my core and becoming, day by day, more myself.
I kind of like this. Try it.
Part 1. Dreaming. Keep dreaming in color and drawing your dreams on cement floors until they are realized. Chapter 1. Unmasked. Fall 2006, New York City. I'm in my dressing room, if you can call it that. It's really a tiny gray space, one that feels as small and colorless as I do on this day. I'm seated in a barber's chair, facing a mirror encircled with bulbs. In moments, I begin my second photo shoot of the day, my fourth this week, on the 3 hours of sleep I live on. My head pounds with exhaustion, and my lips surrender to a slight tremble as I clutch the edge of the stool. In a voice that sounds at once distant and familiar, I hear my name. Allie? 3 years earlier, I'd released my second album. The album everyone calls an artist's jinx. The one that's supposed to fail. But beyond my greatest expectations, The Diary of Alicia Keys exploded. With adrenaline in my veins and gratitude at my back, I'd hit the road on my second tour, glimpsing as little of the country as I had the first time around. Even the circus stays in one place longer than we do, I joke with my crew. We do a show one night and then boom, we're on to the next city. The next hotel room, the next stage, the next blur of buildings flashing past my car window. Half the time I wasn't sure where we were. What's the city again? I'd ask my manager backstage, fearing I'd go out and yell, Houston! To a crowd in Oakland or Atlanta or Detroit. My team was filling every available space in my days while I, overly obligated and out of breath, sprinted hard on a treadmill I knew might suddenly halt. With a lioness's focus and a hustler's determination, I charged ahead. By then, my armor was securely in place. If I woke up feeling down or lethargic or cranky or pissed off, I'd taught myself never to show it. Instead, when any hint of my humanity broke the surface, I shoved it down and plastered on a grin. Alicia, can I take a picture? Sure. Hey, Alicia, can you do another photo shoot? Absolutely. Alicia, can I have your autograph? Of course. I no longer belong to myself. I'd become captive to every request, every demand, every surge of fear that came with even the thought of saying no. And amid the constant moving, the constant packing and unpacking, the constant pleasing and pretending, I delivered my grandest performance yet, convincing the world that behind my smile, all was as perfect as it appeared. In my dressing room on this damp autumn day, the show ends. I study my reflection in the mirror. My face is covered in the layers of makeup used to create another character, another pretense, another retouched version of someone I am not. And all at once, my iron mask turns to thread, unraveling to reveal the face and the emptiness I've kept so carefully hidden away. I do not speak. I do not move. For a moment, I stop breathing. A single tear escapes. Allie, I hear again. I look up to see Erica, my day-to-day manager and my best friend since we were four. She walks toward me. What's going on? The compassion in her tone sends me into a full-fledged ugly cry. My tears tumble out and splash onto my white shirt as I cup my palm over my mouth and attempt to squelch my sobs. Through gulps and stutters, I try to tell her what words feel inadequate to convey, that I'm beyond burnt out, that I've never felt more alone or disconnected from myself, that after years of running, rarely slowing down to breathe and reflect, my body and spirit have come unhinged, disassembled, scattered, lost. You know you don't have to do this, Erica says, gently resting her hand on the small of my back. We'll cancel this thing today. Forget it. You can take a break. A break? On this miraculous path I've walked, this dream that so many stretch toward but seldom grasp, the idea of stepping away has never occurred to me. From my place in the limelight, my role at center stage, relentlessness is the price of being cast. It's the cost of sharing my music, my soul, with a world I feel most connected to through song. And in such a magical storyline, you don't take a break. You don't dare imply you're unhappy. You don't tell your truth and risk appearing ungrateful. Instead, you strap on your boots, you keep your gaze fixed on the road ahead, and you work. You put away your feelings, you put on your daily armor. Until the afternoon, beneath a merry-go-round of unforgiving hot lights, when a quarter century of tears and suppression collapses onto your shirt. I don't just want to break, I tell Erica. I want to bolt. I want to run as far away as I can from this cage I've lived in, this land of fake believe. I stare at my friend, but don't speak the questions reeling through my head. If I take a break, what would happen to all of this? The appearances, the photo shoots, the concerts, all of it. And where would I go? And then, from someplace underneath my soul and beyond my comprehension, an overwhelming response arises. Egypt. Chapter 2, Beginnings.
My name is Terry Agello. I'm Alicia's mom. When I got pregnant with Alicia, I was almost 30 and thinking about moving from New York to L.A. to see what acting opportunities I could get out there. It was 1980. I'd never had a pregnancy, and I called my mother. She said, "Well, you don't do anything easy." There were a couple of candidates who could have been the father. In those days, we were in free love mode. I used the calendar, figured out who it was. I'd known Alicia's father for a long time. We'd been going out, but weren't serious. On our third date, I got pregnant. With protection. People want to come through, don't they? And if you're the vessel, you'd better accept it. I made an appointment for an abortion, and when I got there, I was told, go away. Think about it. I talked to my mom. I talked to my girlfriend. I made a list of pros and cons. Can I do it? I had a good job. I wasn't a teenager. I had a place to live. By the time I told Alicia's father I was expecting, I'd made a decision. I was keeping my baby.
Mommy's body is covered in freckles. The two of us stand close at the intersection of 43rd and 9th, her warm, spotted hand wrapped fully around my tiny one. It's just her and I, both on this corner and in this life. I stare at our fingers intertwined, a swirl of beige and brown. Mommy, I announce, you're still white. My mother glances at me and then back up at the streetlights as it turns green. Yes, Allie, she says, a smile spreading across her face. I'm still white. Now let's go. At 4, I don't understand why my mom's skin doesn't look like my own. I've been waiting for the day when all at once, her hundreds of small dots will march toward one another, link arms, and magically blend to make her brown like me. I know nothing about race and how it can be used to separate and conquer and shame. And in the collage of faces filling our Hell's Kitchen neighborhood, I have no judgment about why we don't resemble each other. Few here do. All I know is that my beloved mother, this woman, who braids my bushel of curls on weekends and sweeps me close at bedtime, is my family, my rock. And in my view, in my innocence, our skin shades should match as closely as our hearts do. My story begins on that corner, in the moment when my curiosity opens its lids. There, hand in hand with the woman who gave me life, I am noticing. I am wondering. For the first time I can recall, I am trying to make sense of the world, and I am questioning how, in the triad I was born into, Mommy and I fit together. My mother is the blackest white woman I know. On Sunday afternoons in our apartment, she'd put on one of her favorite jazz or R&B albums and just let the spirit carry her away. With Miles or Ella or Stevie or Thelonious crooning over long lost love and heartache, Mommy would close her eyes and sway her hips to each soulful note as I, her wide-eyed audience of one, giggled and sang along from my spot on our couch. She was as easily moved by music as she was likely to throw shade at anyone who crossed her. It is from her that I get my silliness, my spontaneity, my passion for the arts, and it was her own parents who once passed those gifts on to her. Mom is a daughter of Detroit, birthplace of Motown and the city where, in 1950, she entered the world as the fourth child in what would grow into a tribe of 9. Mom's parents, Donna Jean and Joseph Little Joe Argello, had met years earlier at Wayne State University. Joe was sitting in a grassy courtyard on campus one afternoon when he heard the voice of an angel, a woman practicing her music in a nearby chorus room. I'm gonna marry that girl, he joked to his friends even before he'd seen Donna Jean. My grandmother turned out to be as gorgeous as she was musically brilliant, and their courtship began. Joe, the son of Italian Catholic immigrants, and Donna, English and Scottish and 2 years younger than her admirer, wed not long after. My grandparents began their lives together in Detroit, but didn't stay there. When my mother was 6, her father, a radio disc jockey, moved the family to Toledo, Ohio, so he could take a job at WOHO Radio. With equal measures of charisma and talent, my grandfather soon won over his listeners as skillfully as he'd once sweet-talked my grandmother. He served not just as the DJ with the silky voice, but also as news director and actor for 2 radio series, The Lone Ranger and The Green Hornet. When Joe wasn't at the station, he was usually rolling around Toledo in his 1955 Thunderbird convertible, preparing to lend his charm to store openings and dance hops. Joe might have stood only 5 feet 6 inches tall, but as my mother recalls, his 100-foot-tall presence filled every room he entered. At home, Donna, an accomplished pianist and vocalist, set aside her musical aspirations to become a homemaker. She was every bit as talented and gregarious as my grandfather, but around the edges, more emotionally delicate. Even before they married, she'd begun to cope with the seesaw of chemical imbalances brought on by manic depression. Joe, though he worked a lot, was his wife's anchor, and to their children, he was both a joyous spirit and a strong disciplinarian. On Sundays after the family returned home from 11 o'clock mass, he'd sometimes roughhouse with the boys or tease the girls, a thunderous laugh rising from deep in his belly. But if anyone got out of line, or if one of my mother's constant pranks went too far, he could shut it down with a single stare. One night in 1963, life in their house forever shifted. My mother, then 12, shared an upstairs bedroom with three of her sisters. Annoyed by a strange noise one of her sisters made while sleeping, Mommy escaped to a pallet on the floor. Through the wooden planks that evening, she heard a scream. She stumbled to her feet, dashed to the top of the staircase, and looked down to see her mother wailing into the receiver. "Please send an ambulance now," her mother begged the operator. Mommy raced downstairs to witness a horror that still lives in her memory. There lay her father, slumped over in his TV chair, holding his chest and gasping for breath while descending into full-blown cardiac arrest. Moments later, the squeal of sirens filled the living room, and a rescue squad wheeled Joe away on a stretcher. He never returned. For weeks after her father's passing, my mother placed his picture on her desk at school. It was her way of keeping him close. And even as she and the family grieved the devastation, they did what the Argellos do best. They soldiered forward. My grandmother looked for work, but because of her fragile mental state, any job she took didn't last. When on her meds, she was steady, but when she'd stop taking them, she'd find herself in the grip of a depressive episode. Her doctors resorted to a treatment that was the go-to remedy at the time, shock therapy. During the electroconvulsive procedure, small electrical currents are sent through a patient's brain, and these shocks are meant to trigger a brief seizure that alters the brain chemistry and temporarily reverses symptoms. I can't imagine the pain my grandmother must have felt as she endured years of this. Donna received some financial help from her own family, but not nearly enough to support 9 children. So everyone who could work did. Mommy had always taken on odd jobs around town, but now she and her siblings worked as a matter of survival. Throughout junior high and high school, my mother weeded yards, worked at the National Biscuit Company, even painted backstops at the baseball field. At school, she kept up with a slew of activities, glee club, dance, cheerleading, with a pace that would later be the blueprint for my own whirlwind childhood. And in her quiet moments, scarce as they were, Mommy dreamed of taking the path her father had once chosen, a career in the arts. She'd caught the acting bug early. A few years before Joe's passing, my mother, while out looking for a babysitting job, connected with Lillian Hannum Dixon, a dance teacher who lived across the street. Mom, the kind of child who'd belt out Somewhere Over the Rainbow while making her bed, a girl with creativity coursing through her veins, spent a lot of time in Miss Dixon's world. She took jazz dance classes down at the Jewish Community Center where Miss Dixon taught. She got involved in theater. And the summer before my mother graduated from Central Catholic High School, Miss Dixon took her to New York City to experience the magic of a Broadway show. "Your father never would have wanted any of his children in the arts," my grandmother would often tell my mother. "It's a nasty business." But Mommy's desire had already taken root. "You know how to dance," Miss Dixon told her after she'd finished high school. "Now go to New York and learn how to act." In 1969, she auditioned for and was accepted into New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. With only the waitressing tips she'd saved up, she set out for the world's most fiercely competitive city. Mommy hustled. Between coursework and auditions, she worked for the telephone company and took on temp jobs. She landed a handful of roles in off and off-off Broadway productions, but even after she'd completed her degree, she couldn't fully support herself with stage work. She was still living from one temp gig to the next when she got her miracle on 42nd Street, Manhattan Plaza, a sprawling residential complex spanning West 42nd and 43rd Streets between 9th and 10th Avenues and Hell's Kitchen, flung open its doors to artists. More than two-thirds of the federally subsidized units were set aside for those who made their living in dance, theater, music, and television. Rent, thankfully, was a percentage of residents' feast or famine incomes. Mommy applied and got a 46th-floor studio, the first place she could comfortably afford. Those towers would end up being the backdrop for my childhood, the set on which my own dreams took shape and took flight. In that complex, in the shadows of Mommy's apartment on a spring evening in 1980, I was conceived. And what began as an act of passion grew into an uncertainty, a question mark over whether I'd ever make it into the world. My father wasn't there when I was born. On that January evening in 1981, as the city's temperatures flirted with the freezing mark, Mommy arrived at the hospital already in labor. Her own doctor didn't make it in time for the delivery, so she was placed in the care of a resident, one who didn't give her the episiotomy she needed. Mommy, ripped and swollen and stitched back together, lay in bed wondering how she'd come up with the money for the hospital bill. The next day, before Mommy and I left the hospital, but well after the delivery drama was over, my father, Craig Cook, strode into the newborn ward with his newest girlfriend at his side. The whole scene can be summed up in three words: awkward as hell. The story of that day is, in many ways, the story of my relationship with Craig. He wasn't there, and then, once the difficult moments had come and gone, he'd suddenly show up, only to vanish again. There were occasions, of course, when he spent time with me, memories now scattered and dim, like the time when he and his first wife took me, then about four, to St. Thomas on a beach vacation, or those afternoons starting when I was around 10, when he'd occasionally pick me up from school and call me Skittles, the nickname he gave me in tribute to one of my favorite candies. But for a young girl like me, one who clung to my mother's hand as closely as I did to her side, my father's easy grin and handful of annual visits were not enough. And when he did come to see me, I felt uneasy around him, the way you feel uncomfortable in a new pair of shoes. Technically they fit, but the leather hasn't lived on your feet long enough to learn their grooves and tendencies. I'm sure Craig loved me in the ways in which he was then capable. Like all parents, he did what he knew how to do. I'm also sure there were circumstances involved that I couldn't have grasped, grown folks' issues that somehow blocked the doorway of our connection. Yet at 5 and 8 and 11, I only knew the world through the eyes of a child. I only understood what it felt like in the early hours of the morning as I lay staring at the ceiling from my futon to wonder why I had seemingly been set aside. And in that world, in that reality, I grasped only what I was missing, the irrefutable affirmation that I, my father's child, mattered more to him than anything. When Craig showed up at the hospital after my birth, he stepped into our shared story and out of his personal one. My father, who is about 2 years younger than my mom, came of age in the 70s, a time when America itself was at a pivot point. In Harlem, Craig was reared under the gracious palm of his mother, Virgil, who'd moved from Annapolis, Maryland, to New York City to study nursing in the early 1950s. She was a pioneer in her day. A black woman from the South was expected to marry young and become a maid or a housewife, not venture north hundreds of miles to attend college. While a student, she got pregnant with my father and began raising him on her own, even as she completed her studies and eventually graduated as a nurse. She and Craig's father never married. My paternal grandmother, in a display of interracial free-spiritedness rarely witnessed during her times, then met and fell in love with Miguel Michael Giuseppe De Salvatore, an Italian-American who worked with his brothers-in-law at a fruit stand in Harlem. They'd already been together for years when my Nana and Fafa, as I called them, traded vows. "I'm gonna buy you a house," Fafa announced to Nana after they tied the knot. Nana already had an enormous, beautifully decorated apartment in Harlem, but wanting to let Fafa step into his role as the man of the family, she allowed him to move her to a rancher that was two-thirds the size of her former place. In their new Long Island home, they adopted and raised two more children. By then, Fafa had already set aside his work at the fruit stand to become a cop. Craig, who was 16 when Nana and Fafa married, was only a couple years away from leaving home to attend Morehouse College in Atlanta. College, it turned out, wasn't for him. After a year of studies, he returned to New York to work briefly as a clerk in the district attorney's office and then for a year as an NYPD officer in Harlem's 28th precinct. He eventually landed a job as a salesman at a high-end clothing store on the Upper East Side. Tall, dapper, and charismatic, Craig was already a hit with the ladies when a mutual friend introduced him to my mother. Their friendship grew into a mild flirtation that later blossomed into the night I was conceived. By then, Craig had traded his sales job for a career as a flight attendant based first in Queens and later in Missouri and Colorado. For most of my childhood, he was constantly on the road, flying in and out of town with the same unpredictability with which he seemed to show up in my world. Craig never knew his own biological father. His birth certificate listed only his dad's name and occupation, policeman. "Do you want to meet him?" his mother had asked a few times when he was a boy. Craig had no interest. Between his mom and his stepfather, Michael, he had all the love and nurturing he needed, he'd tell me years later. Yet, I've often thought about how the absence of Craig's father must have impacted his relationship with me, perhaps in ways he was not conscious of. I can only imagine how Craig, fatherless himself, must have felt on that summer afternoon when my mother sat across from him and said she was expecting me and that, yes, he was the father. He was just 27 then, and, as he recalls it, still trying to find himself. As far as he was concerned, things had turned out well enough for him even without his dad around. The child my mother was carrying was undoubtedly his. But, as he told her on that day, he wasn't prepared to put on the heavy mantle of fatherhood. Only now, as a parent myself, can I understand what may have been true. Craig was living out of the template he'd inherited. In the empty space left by Craig, my Nana and Fafa stepped in. When Craig first told his mother that he had a baby on the way, she said to him, "Until that child crosses my threshold, I don't know anything about it." Upon my arrival, my mother wrote a letter to Craig's mom, telling her everything sweet about her new grandbaby. Not long after, Craig showed up at his mother's doorstep, cradling me in the crease of his elbow. "Here's your grandchild," he announced proudly, handing me to Nana. She took me in her arms and never let me go. In Nana and Fafa's unfailing embrace, I thrived. A couple of weekends a month, my grandfather would make the drive from Long Island to pick me up for a visit at his and Nana's house. They rarely missed one of my piano recitals or pageants. My mother's mom, Grandma Donna, did watch me when she flew in from Toledo, but Nana and Fafa, my only local extended family, served as my mother's primary safety net. They kept me whenever Mommy traveled for a job she'd taken by then as a paralegal at a law firm in Rockefeller Center. Each time Mom walked me down to meet Fafa in front of our building, He'd already be there waiting, gray fedora, trench coat, leaning back against his car, gun holstered on his hip, old school Italian style. "That's my girl," he'd call out as soon as I emerged from our building's revolving door. Moments later, I was buckled in and on my way to the only other home outside of our apartment where I felt seen. My Nana and Fafa, and later my brother Cole, who is a decade younger than I am, would be Craig's greatest gifts to me. Yet even with such committed grandparents, I had a deep sense early on of the truth. In this world, it was my mother and me. That was all. She was my person, and I was hers. Never was that said aloud, but the feeling permeated our every exchange. In one of my favorite photos, now bent and faded, my mother stares down at me, her hair cascading over her plaid shirt, her eyes soft. I, then three, sit quietly at her side. In my mother's gaze, I see grace. I see her profound love for her only child, a baby she once bravely chose to keep. I see a woman whose father was gone too soon, and a mother determined to protect her own little girl from life's sharpest edges. I see someone who, on a prayer and a paralegal's meager paycheck, called on heaven to help her firmly ground me. A defining experience of my childhood began with a simple question. Got room for a piano? It was spring of 1987, and my mother and I were visiting our neighbors in the 9th Avenue building of Manhattan Plaza. While I was playing with my friend, our mothers caught up. My friend's mom mentioned that her family would be moving soon. Her husband, a musician and piano tuner, had an extra piano. That's when she asked my mother the question that would alter my path. Did we have space for an upright? "I'd love to take it," Mommy said without hesitation. "Well, if you can move it," the woman said, "you can have it." 1 week and 50 bucks later, two men from Beethoven Piano showed up and loaded the upright onto a dolly as I watched from the terrace window in our living room. The piano teetered on its platform as the workers wheeled it across the center courtyard toward our tower on 10th Avenue, up the service elevator, and at last into the doorway of our apartment. Since the afternoon that piano was scooted into the center of our living room, little has been the same. The first time I'd seen a piano, I was mesmerized. My kindergarten teacher, Miss Hazel, a former dancer intent on opening up the world of artistic expression to her students, would put together shows like Cats and Dreamgirls and have us audition for roles. I was once chosen to play Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, which is how I discovered I had a voice and loved to use it. But it was the piano that called to me. Miss Hazel would often invite musicians to perform for us in our school's auditorium, and there, one afternoon, sat a woman at an upright, her long, slender fingers dancing gracefully over the charcoal and ivory keys. For me, the initial attraction was entirely visual. I loved the way the splintered piano stood, proud and unapologetic, and how the beauty of its sleek, shiny keys contrasted with the roughness of its wooden frame. When the performance ended that day, I lingered in the auditorium just so I could run my little fingers across the keys, marveling as much at its sound as I did at its beauty. Mommy never pushed me toward the piano. As a first grader before we received the upright, I asked her if I could take lessons, and she agreed, probably while calculating the overtime she'd have to work in order to pay for them. Upon hearing I'd requested training, my Fafa bought me an electric keyboard, one small enough to tuck into the far corner of our living room. Margaret Pine, a pianist who came highly recommended to my mother, would be my only piano teacher from when I was six until I graduated from high school. From the first C major chord I struck, I was smitten. By then, my mother, determined to help me discover my muse and keep me out of trouble in a neighborhood known for it, was already filling my days with one activity after another. My schedule would eventually include Alvinelli dance classes, gymnastics, and ballet. A friend of my mom, Lecky Brown, even helped me land my first TV gig. At age 4, I played Maria, a playmate of Rudy Huxtable on The Cosby Show. I enjoyed acting, but time and time again as I grew older, I'd always return to the art form that still draws me in most powerfully, piano. As much of a miracle as Fafa's keyboard was for me, it didn't have the same feel and sound as a real piano. I secretly longed for an upright like the one I'd seen at school. Which is why, on that afternoon when our secondhand piano bumped across our threshold, I felt like I was inheriting a Steinway grand. The upright was dented and scratched and badly out of tune. Mommy said it appeared to be one of those player pianos that could operate itself, a relic of the 1920s and 30s. The self-playing mechanism had been removed, but the space for it remained. The yellowed keys were badly chipped in a few places. The bench, with its crooked legs and cracked seat, hadn't come with the piano. Its wood was an entirely different shade. And yet its very imperfection, the way the bench and piano didn't resemble each other any more than my skin matched my mother's, is what made it so perfect. The piano instantly became our living room divider, replacing the Chinese folding screen we'd been using up until then. By this time, my mother had traded her studio for a one-bedroom. She tried for a two-bedroom so we could each have our own space, but the building management wouldn't allow it. If I'd been a boy, she was told, we could have had two rooms. I guess they figured a girl could sleep with her mother. Over the years, that little apartment got rearranged a lot. Sometimes my mother carved out her own space in the living room and gave me the bedroom. Other times, our tall bookcase served as the divider while the piano rested flush against the wall. But for most of my childhood, that upright compartmentalized my two worlds. My futon bed and dresser sat on one side of the living room. Our couch, entertainment center, and small dining table lived on the other. With each passing year, Miss Pine gently prodded me into new musical territory. In the beginning, I'd sit for hours on the hard bench, tediously plucking through my scales until the coral streaks of sunlight filling our apartment gave way to gray shadows. As I advanced, I trained in the Suzuki method, a rigorous Japanese approach to piano mastery. I took on Beethoven sonatas, Mozart concertos, and Satie preludes before eventually moving on to the jazz standards of Ellington, Waller, and McPartlin. During my afternoon rehearsals, my rendition of Joplin's The Entertainer rose to mix with the musical gumbo of Hell's Kitchen, the thumpity-thump of hip-hop and salsa and Tupac and Salt-N-Pepa and Prince right alongside the flutes and banjos and script readings overheard in the halls. Over many decades, Manhattan Plaza served as a home to a parade of artistic masters, from Samuel L. Jackson, who once worked as a building security guard, to Tennessee Williams, Larry David, Kenny Kramer, Terrence Howard, and Patrick Dempsey. In such a haven, my daily rehearsals drew no death stares or neighbor complaints. Chopin was my homie. His compositions were poetry for the piano, layered measure by measure with the dark passion and poignancy that still speaks to me. Miss Pine believed, as I do, that great music is not confined to one style. As she guided me in studying the greats in every genre, she also encouraged me to add my own flair, to play from my heart. If I heard a song I loved on the radio, like Brian McKnight's Never Felt This Way, she'd have me create and perform my own composition. Her approach wasn't traditional, but it was genius because it kept me tuned in. It kept me coming back. Even when, at age 11, I begged my mom to let me quit because A, I could see that we couldn't truly afford it, and B, I wanted to play outside with my friends when the weather was warm, my mother flatly refused. "Quit what you like," she told me, "but you're not quitting the piano." We eventually struck a compromise. As long as I practiced diligently during the school year, I could have summers off. Mommy knew then what I know now. I was put on the planet to play. I'm not sure how much of identity comes threaded in our genes and how much of it is shaped by our environment, but as far back as I can recall, placing my fingertips on a keyboard, felt like coming home to myself. There was no courtship phase, no period of becoming acquainted with the piano. Rather, the connection was instantaneous, as comfortable and familiar for me as breathing. On those afternoons when I had the apartment to myself, I'd slide up to the keys and lean into the music, the world growing quieter as I gave myself over to the flow of the notes. Through my fingertips, through hour after hour of delicious solitude, I expressed what words felt inadequate to convey. "Who is this?" my mother snapped. On our house phone, I'd been flirting with some boy from school when Mom picked up the second receiver. "Alicia has to go," she cut in before either of us could speak. "It's past her bedtime. Click." My mother was no joke. By day, she prepared legal briefs and draft pleadings. By night, she served as Chief Justice Argello, the enforcer whose sole mission was to keep me in check. "When your mother sits on the high court, you gotta learn to be slick. You gotta live on your tiptoes. You must stay ready to present your evidence when she launches into one of her rapid-fire cross-examinations. What were you thinking? What do you mean when you say that? And why the hell is there a used condom underneath the couch?" Most of the time when she tore into me, I stood there looking as stupid as I felt on the evening when she hung up on my crush. "He's just a friend," I pleaded as she reminded me of the rules. "No calls after 9 p.m. and no boys in our apartment between the time I arrived home from school and when she came in from work." I frequently got busted on both fronts. Mommy was intense. She still is. If my father's absence is part of what formed me, Mommy's fire and fervor completed the job. With her, there was seldom an emotional middle ground. If she was angry, she was 1,000% furious, and I, the only other person in our apartment, became skillful at peacemaking. If she was offering you her time or a listening ear, she was the most generous and beautiful giver known to womankind. And if Mom and her friends grooved to the sounds of Smokey or Curtis or Sly and the Family Stone, she was the first to tear up the dance floor and the very last to leave it. No one was more passionate, and I and everyone else knew exactly how she was feeling because she never pretended otherwise. What I didn't know from one day to the next was which side of her I'd encounter, Mom the nurturer or Mom the interrogator. The year I turned 13, I asked my mother if I could go with my friends to see The Mask, a Jim Carrey flick. She agreed. The next day, as she and I were taking the bus somewhere together, she quizzed me. "How was the movie?" she asked. "Oh, it was so funny," I exclaimed, laughing a bit too hard. "Man, I can't believe how crazy that story was." Mommy stared at me without smiling or blinking. "And what happened that made it so crazy?" she asked. "Oh, there was a part where Jim Carrey got stuck," I said. "Got stuck how?" "I mean, he just got stuck," I told her. I can't really remember. I don't know why I even tried to lie to my mother. That woman can sniff out a pile of horse manure from the farthest corner of Queens. In less than a minute, she squeezed the truth from me. I had never seen the Jim Carrey film. Instead, I'd watched the movie she'd been forbidding me to see. My friends and I had sneaked our way into some theater that was playing Basic Instinct, complete with the interrogation scene in which Sharon Stone uncrosses her legs to reveal a pantyless crotch. I rightfully almost got a beatdown for that one. Later that same year, I had the nerve to beg my mother for a beeper, that device that was all the rage before cell phones were hot. "What does a 14-year-old need with a pager?" she asked me. Case closed, until I got creative and teamed up with an ally. My friend Misha, who's several years older than me, had always been my big sis in our building. My mother trusted her. If I got a beeper, Misha persuaded my mother one evening, then she could track me down anytime. Upon receiving a page from my mother, I could find a payphone, remember those, and immediately call her. Mom bought that argument but couldn't afford the beeper, so my godmother, Titi Ali, paid for it. I won that round but lost plenty of others, like my quest to get some door knockers, those hoop earrings so enormous you can fit your fist through them. Out of the question, said Mom. My mother had to be strict as a matter of my survival. I grew up near Times Square before it became Disneyland, during a time when Hell's Kitchen lived up to its name. The kitchen, in most homes, is the place where the action goes down, where everyone passes through or congregates. It's hot, it attracts dirt, it's often loud and odorous. All accurate descriptions of my old stomping grounds. During the early 90s, the crossroads of the world was still an X-rated cesspool of filth open for business around the clock. At any one of the shops on the street around the corner from our apartment, a kid could easily get anything and everything. A fake ID, like the one I used to sneak into a club called Tunnel. A fistful of blunts, I smoked my share. A pack of condoms, which led to the used one that somehow got lost under the couch on the afternoon I lost my virginity. Trouble lingered on every corner. Pimps beating down sex workers who were short on their earnings. Homeless people laying huddled in garbage bags to protect themselves from the blistering cold. Addicts slumped forward in heroin stupors. Gypsy cabs dropping off men in search of a good time. It was home to the city's have-nots, a hotbed of society's misfits. Mom, who usually crawled in from work after grueling 14-hour days, taught me early how to handle myself on the streets. Stay aware of your surroundings, she'd warned me. Honestly, she didn't have to teach me much, because the city itself hands you its rule book. Walk the other way. Never stare. Don't engage. And at all times, keep moving. By age 11, I was already catching the train and city bus alone from school and back to our apartment, arriving just in time for a check-in call from a mother who was not to be effed with. I always felt older than I was. For one thing, New York grows you up fast, and for another, I skipped 2 grades, 1st and 11th. I entered kindergarten already able to read, probably because my paralegal mom had taught me to sound out big words like affidavit and subpoena. All through school, I was simultaneously ahead and behind. A smart and enthusiastic student striving for my gold star, and the youngest, though somehow still the tallest, of all of my classmates. But you couldn't have told me I wasn't grown. As my mother recalls, I showed up on Earth as a bit of an old spirit, one who savored my alone time. I was happy to play with other children, but also content to see them leave, eager to reclaim my space, my silence, my solo hours at the piano. I'm still that way. I was a tomboy, mostly out of necessity, and partly because I thought the wardrobe was fresh. Oversized sweaters, baggy pants, Timberland boots, that's all I wore from 5th grade on. I dressed so I could outrun any stranger who might try to test me. Plus, wearing anything form-fitting could get you mistaken for a hooker, or at least send the message that you might be interested. I pulled my thick hair back into the tightest bun, my frizz forced into submission by a single rubber band and gel. Occasionally, I'd wear some 70s-style Stevie Wonder braids with beads, but that was as girly as I got. I never, ever got my nails done, and besides, I needed to keep them short for rocking the piano. I hated anything frou-frou, floral prints, lace, pink, skirts, and to go along with my boyish attire, I had a mouth on me, a hard edge meant to scare off the crazies while guarding my sensitivities. My self-protective instinct spilled over into my social relationships. Even as a small child, I seldom fully trusted anyone, nor did I reveal the real me. Too risky. To this day, I don't know exactly what led me to build mountains between myself and others. Maybe it began with the teasing. When I was 4, one of my friends accidentally scissored off several of my long braids, and a barber then had to chop all my hair short. You look like a boy, the other kids screamed when they saw my little crop of cotton. My fro eventually grew into a heap of wild, disobedient curls that Mom often swept into two giant poofs. The teasing grew louder. Having a name like Alicia Argello Cook didn't quiet the insults. Alicia cooks Jello, I'd hear constantly. When I was around 9, I joined my school's track team. Those tiny shorts put on display my thick legs, which drew stares and whispers from my classmates. Or maybe I turned inward the year I was 11. My ballet teacher, thin and lanky, ordered me to tuck in my thick behind after I had already tried to do so. With her second request, I became acutely aware that my butt was never going to tuck in as tightly as those of my classmates with smaller backsides. I suddenly felt self-conscious about a curvaceous figure that I'd been mostly happy with up until then. It's hard to pinpoint the precise moment when we internalize others' assessments. It's usually not just a single experience, but rather a series of moments that bruise the spirit and lead us to distrust ourselves and those around us. And then we wake up at age 17 or 25 or 37 and realize we don't know the last time we've lived life only to please ourselves. Thankfully, race was never a part of what made me feel guarded. Being mixed, for me, didn't come with a major identity crisis or the typical interracial angst. That's in part because New York City is one enormous United Nations, a stew pot of ethnicities and cultures and head wraps and accents representing more than 150 countries around the globe. No one even questioned my heritage in a city that cares most about your aspirations and less about where you've come from. Based on the chorus of daily, "Hey, mommy," catcalls I got from construction workers along 9th Avenue, many assumed I was Puerto Rican or some other kind of Latinx. "You're the best of both worlds," my mother would often remind me, and she was right. Yet since my mom understood that America would always compel me to choose, to mark one box versus another, she raised me with an awareness that's still intact. I am a Black girl. I had a tight crew from a young age, and while I felt at home with them, even they didn't glimpse the full me. I'd known Misha, my Beepergate co-conspirator, practically since birth. The same was true of two other girls, Kat, whose mother was both friend and neighbor to my mother before Kat and I were born, and Erica, Misha's younger cousin and a childhood friend, who years later would work with me. It was Misha and two of her other cousins, Sasha and Julie, who invited me to join their musical girl group. Misha, whose father Norman Hedman was a renowned percussionist who at that time worked with New Kids on the Block, was probably 18 then. Her cousins might have been 16 or 17. At 9, I was by far the youngest, and I had to be a little fast to keep up with their speed. We took ourselves super seriously, rehearsing our pop songs, coordinating our moves, and vibing out in the building's plaza for hours on end. I was convinced we'd be the next Jackson 5, which would have made me the new baby Michael. That was my secret dream. At 11, I moved on to entrepreneurial pursuits. I, along with a few friends, started a babysitter's club inspired by the book series. From my living room, I managed the entire operation. $5 an hour for us to watch any school-age child in the towers. That gig lasted a couple of years before I joined another girl group during my first year in high school. Because of the grade skip, I enrolled in the professional performing arts school when I was just 13. Being there felt like living on the set of Glee, but our one building school was a much smaller version. There was algebra and English and chemistry and French to learn, of course, but seemingly right there with us in our classrooms and roaming the halls were the legends we studied. From Duke Ellington, Sarah Vaughan, and Billie Holiday to Scott Joplin, Led Zeppelin, and Carole King. My jazz instructor, Miss Aziza, is one of the greatest teachers on the planet, a badass pianist and vocal powerhouse who turned me on to composing, arranging, and the beauty of harmonizing. She was one of the first Black women I knew who did it all as an artist, my real-life Nina Simone. My classmates, all of whom reveled in song and dance and theater as much as I did, became my people. And yet through every age and stage, I kept my mask in position. The less others really knew about me, I reasoned, the less ammunition they'd have to make me look foolish. Only if I revealed my tender spots could they wound me. My true self, the one I kept so deeply concealed, only emerged in my diaries. There, I could unveil. If Mom got heated and I got tongue-tied, I could escape to sort out my thoughts and gather my words before the two of us spoke again. And alongside my musings and misgivings lived my poetry, my unfinished lyrics, my schoolgirl crushes, my feelings about Craig. On cotton pages scrawled with purple ink, I didn't have to be tough or brave or capable or strong. I could just be me. Chapter 3, Flying Solo.